You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. History may remember 2020 for many things, but the impeachment proceedings playing out in the U.S. Senate are part of an ongoing conversation about the American experiment and how its three-legged structure of government can survive. Professor Barbara McQuaid is a former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan, now with the University of Michigan's Law School. And she published an essay this week in the academic journalism website The Conversation, arguing for this as an important moment in questions of executive power. Barb McQuaid, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks, April. Glad to be here.
You point out that one of the main outstanding questions in the extent of executive is the extent of executive privilege. Don McGahn, former White House counsel to the president, has declined to obey a subpoena in the House impeachment proceedings and appealed the judge's order to comply. What could the resolution of his case tell us?
Yeah, April, you know, you used an interesting phrase there when you said that our government is a three-legged stool. I sometimes refer to it as a game of rock, paper, scissors. You know, each one is equally powerful and can serve as a check on the other. And with regard to executive privilege, that is a way for the executive branch to say to Congress, we're going to stop your oversight ability by playing this card, by using executive privilege. And it is a recognized doctrine. It plays an important role. It allows a president to say, I want to encourage frank and candid conversations with my highest level aides without the chilling effect that might exist if they knew that their conversations could one day become public. And that has value, and we want to protect that. But in the past, in the case of United States versus Nixon, the Supreme Court said this is not spelled out in the Constitution. It's kind of a court-made construct, but it does have value. We recognize it, but it has some limitations. What President Trump has done with regard to Don McGahn and others is to say, not only do I have executive privilege, but I have something called absolute immunity. And that means that my close aides don't even have to show up when Congress serves them with a subpoena. And so he has taken executive privilege and really ramped it up a notch. That challenge, that Congress has challenged that. Some committees have brought legal suits challenging that assertion of executive privilege. And in particular, this case involving Don McGahn, a district court judge has decided that there is no such thing as absolute immunity. You have to show up and at least answer questions subject to a question-by-question basis before you can assert executive privilege. And I think we're going to see in the coming months in the courts of appeals and maybe at the Supreme Court what the contours of that may be. So through this litigation, I think we're going to get some answers to some questions about the limits of executive privilege.
U.S. courts have functioned under something called political doctrine. And as you point out, the judiciary does not want to referee every single dispute between the executive branch and Congress. But there is at least some room for discussion about whether the courts can wade into impeachment matters when there's a question of fairness. If the Trump defense team wanted to go there, what would the president's attorneys have to prove to a court to show that the Senate's proceedings have been unfair?
This is another area where I think we're in uncharted waters. As you mentioned, there is this doctrine known as the political question doctrine, which says that courts should not wade into issues that are best left to the political branches, meaning the executive branch and the legislative branch. Courts are there to decide legal questions. They call it justiciability, and not to decide political questions. They shouldn't decide matters of policy. They shouldn't decide whether we should be allies with Ukraine or we should have different foreign policy. And so in some of the questions that come up in the impeachment context, for example, there's a case involving a judge named, ironically enough, Nixon. Walter Nixon. This causes some confusion from time to time because there's so little case law on impeachment, and two of them are named Nixon. But in a case involving a judge, Walter Nixon, he was impeached and removed from office.
Yeah, people sometimes forget federal judges can be removed from the bench if they are impeached.
Right. And that, you know, it's not just the president. It is government officials, including judges. And there was a judge, Walter Nixon, in the 1980s who was removed from office. He filed a lawsuit trying to essentially appeal his removal from office, the decision of the Senate to remove him from office. He appealed that. And in that case, the court said, no, this is a political question. The Constitution gives the sole power of removal from office upon impeachment to the Senate. And so it would be improper for us to look into that. Now, they did leave just a little bit of wiggle room in that case that said that in a case of gross violations of due process, maybe that would be another matter. But in terms of just the wisdom of the decision to remove from office on this basis, that's not for us to decide. That's an issue for the Senate. And so similarly, in the Trump impeachment proceedings, if someone were to run to the courts on some of these issues, I think we might learn the contours of the political question doctrine in the impeachment context. Imagine if there was a scenario where, say, you know, John Bolton were subpoenaed by the Senate and President Trump asserted executive privilege. Would Chief Justice Roberts decide that? Would the Senate itself decide if they wanted to compel him to appear? And what if President Trump went to the courts to try to get an order to prevent that compulsion order, to challenge it? Would the courts hear that, or would they say, nope, hands off for us, that's a political question? I think President Trump could at least probably get a delay of the impeachment proceedings while the case made its way through the courts. And then ultimately, would they decide, as they did in the case of Walter Nixon, that hands off for us in an impeachment proceeding? Or is this really the only way to break this logjam between the executive and the legislative branch when it comes to an impeachment question? Unknown.
Are you saying that it's not really clear where the benchmark lies to prove unfairness in a Senate proceeding?
That's right. I think that most often when there are these battles between the executive and the legislative branch over issues like privilege or other questions, the two branches go through what's known as the negotiation and accommodation process. They don't want to resort to the courts. They know the courts don't want to answer the questions. And so they work out some sort of compromise. And they agree, well, perhaps we won't produce everything you've asked for, but we'll give you these things that you really need. And the legislature will say, yes, we'll take it and avoid a court battle and we'll move on. President Trump has vowed to, quote, fight all the subpoenas. And when one party stakes out a position like that, the I'm not going to budge, sometimes it does require courts to intervene in that scenario. But if the courts say hands off, we're not going to get involved because it's a political question, then it's not clear how those issues get resolved.
Negotiation and accommodation, two words that have been conspicuously lacking in Washington lately. Does the case to prove unfairness of impeachment proceedings become harder when Republicans hold a Senate majority?
I don't know if it's necessarily because it's Republicans, but I think it's when you have the party of the president, the same party represented in the Senate. And I think one thing that is different, and maybe this is the way it will always be forevermore, it is my observation and my opinion that the Republican majority in the Senate is treating their treatment of President Trump very much in a political manner as opposed to regarding themselves as a separate branch of government that is there to serve as an independent check on a co-equal branch of government. And I think that is something, if you read the Federalist Papers, that is really not envisioned by the framers of the Constitution, that party loyalty would prevail over loyalty to the institution. And I think that's where we are seeing this breakdown in the Senate as an effective check on presidential power.
Do you know the mechanism that would be used to decide that? I mean, if the president's attorneys try to press the issue that the political question is not in force here and that the judiciary needs to settle the limits of presidential power, I mean, is that something that would have to be discussed in federal court?
Yes. I mean, I think what it would take is actually filing a lawsuit by somebody, whether it is a committee seeking to compel compliance with a subpoena, or if there was a compulsion order issued by Chief Justice Roberts in the impeachment, perhaps a lawsuit brought by President Trump to quash that subpoena and to resist the subpoena. I think that would go to the courts for resolution. And what's interesting is if the courts decided they did not want to get into it, for example, there has been a judge in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals in one of the subpoena matters who has said when a subpoena relates to impeachment, It is a political question that courts cannot decide. Judge Rao on the D.C. Circuit has said that. It was a dissenting opinion. She did not have the majority there. But there does seem to be uncertainty as to whether a court would be willing to decide. Now, if the parties themselves cannot work it out and it's come to that, I don't know that the courts have much choice, because otherwise we are left at a stalemate. And I don't know if that's a satisfactory outcome. Stalemate means that the party who is the non-moving party, I guess, just prevails by default.
Trump's defense, the president's defense team argues that there is no criminal conduct here and that voters are the best arbiters of whether the president's use of power is in the end appropriate. Let's say the Senate votes to acquit, which seems likely, and the president wins a second term in November. Is there anything else that other branches of government could do at that point?
Well, not to, I guess there's always the impeachment power to start over and remove him from office. But I think as a political matter, if the president is not removed from office in this impeachment and then is reelected, it would seem politically difficult to go through another impeachment. I suppose that I would think that Congress will have been weakened if that is the case, because the House did impeach President Trump. And then if the voters were to say, you know, sort of reaffirm his behavior by reelecting him as president, I think what they are saying essentially is that we do not think that the conduct for which he was impeached is sufficient to remove someone from office. I think that sends a message to future presidents that they can engage in similar behavior. You know, one of the reasons prosecutors prosecute criminal cases is to deter that kind of behavior from others in the future. And if President Trump is successful in avoiding removal from office and is successful in being reelected, then I think they have failed in that deterrent effect. And I think that a message has been sent that presidents can get away with this kind of behavior and voters don't care.
Well, is there any reason that the voters should not be the jury? There is an ocean of information available online about what happened during the call to Ukraine. What's wrong with letting the process play out in that manner?
Well, the framers of the Constitution thought otherwise. They thought that removal from office should be done by the House through impeachment and the Senate through removal, rather than waiting for the next election to come around. Certainly, voters have the ability to do that and to serve as a check even on Congress. But I think one of the arguments that the House managers have made is we can't wait until the next election because President Trump poses a clear and present danger to election security. It is the election itself that is the very subject of the impeachment articles, because President Trump is seeking to undermine the results of that election. And we can't be confident in the results of that election if President Trump is permitted to behave that the way that he has. And so there's been this argument that impeachment would effectively be undoing the past election and tearing up the ballots. But under that theory, then no president should ever be impeached. And that's certainly not what the framers of the Constitution intended.
Barb, you mentioned the fact that the courts, the appeals court system is still dealing with the question of whether Don McGahn should obey a subpoena and the challenge to executive privilege that that case represents. The House proceedings are over with. Do you think that that case is going to be resolved before the Senate comes to the end of its process? Will it be a moot point?
I don't think it's going to be resolved before the Senate comes to the end of its process here. I don't know that it means it's a moot point, because the president could always be impeached for other behavior. The McGahn information really goes to the obstruction of justice allegations that arise from Robert Mueller's report. Don McGahn is listed many, many times in the Mueller report because he was interviewed, and the House wants an opportunity to question him about some of those same matters. So it would really be a different impeachment inquiry, I think. I think they could open it again as a matter of law. Now, I suppose as a matter of politics, it would be difficult to successfully have another impeachment inquiry without getting a lot of blowback, I think, from the public. If they're not successful in this effort, I think that there would be some fatigue among the public and probably even members of the House itself.
You note in your article that there's really a hybrid of legal and political procedures in play here for which we're off the map. There's no playbook. What are we to make of this? How is it that we've found ourselves in this place where there is no set of guidance for what is going on?
I think we find ourselves here because President Trump is such a buster of norms. He's a disruptor. He has behaved very differently from other presidents in the past. I think, as we discussed earlier, whereas most members of the executive branch in prior administrations have been willing to participate in the negotiation and accommodation process, for example, President Trump says, I will fight all the subpoenas. He's a fighter. He's a counterpuncher. He's a disruptor. And so I think that failure to follow norms means that if it is not written into the law, we can't count on him to go along with the status quo or the way things have done in the past. I think it will cause us to reexamine some of the ways that we do things in government. Do we need to enshrine into law some of the things that were always just our assumptions and make them laws? But, you know, at the end of the day, it's sort of when I was U.S. attorney, one of the things that it was often said is the way to avoid personnel problems and management problems is to hire good people. And I think that voters would be wise to take that advice, that the way to avoid problems in management of our government is to elect good presidents. And if you have a disruptor, it's not all bad. The presidency has evolved in prior generations by people who have thought and acted outside the box. And change certainly is sometimes a very good thing. But when you have people willing to flout the law and to disrespect co-equal branches of government, I do think that voters should think twice about whether that's the kind of person who is wielding power responsibly.
Can you give us a sense of how judges and legal scholars navigate these situations where there truly is no hard and fast guidance?
It's difficult when, you know, typically what courts and lawyers do is they look for precedent. Are there prior court cases on the same issue that we can look to and say this case is either like that prior case or it's different in an important way? And that's a way to navigate the space. Or is there a statute that governs this situation? And you look to those things. In the absence of those things, then it's a lot more difficult. And you have to look to what are our values and expectations, looking at things like the Federalist Papers. You know, that's something that I think many of us hadn't thought about since our days studying constitutional law. But you'll see a lot of references to Federalist Number 65 and what Alexander Hamilton wrote. And so I think getting back to the core values of our democracy are the things that I look to. We care in this country about separation of powers. We care in this country about democracy. We care about transparency in government. And so looking to all of those things, how do you reconcile those values with what we're doing and where we want to go as a country?
It's so difficult when one of your pieces of contemporary case law regards Andrew Johnson. Well, thank you for taking a few minutes to talk with us about this. And
you bet.
We'll have a link to the article up online. We appreciate your time.
Thanks so much for having me.